Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion about the surprise Republican candidate for president who has already left many of her rivals in the dust, including Sarah Palin. Ed Feline, the publisher and editor of the Southside Pride, Minneapolis's alternative monthly newspaper, joins us to talk about Michelle Bachmann, who may be a joke to many liberals but is clearly a favorite of a lot of Republican primary voters. Then we will talk about the health of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, who is in Cuba recovering from surgery and is rumored to have prostate cancer that has metastasized into his pelvis. We'll be joined by Michael Shifter, who is the director of the Inter-American Dialogue and a professor at Georgetown University. He will fill us in on the power vacuum in Venezuela and the various factions that might try to fill it if the prognosis for Hugo Chavez is as grim as some claim. Then, with the possibility of a showdown over another flotilla heading for Gaza and further embarrassment for Israel, we will talk with Daniel Byman, the author of a new book, A High Price: The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. He will analyze the political costs of the lack of a peace process between a fractious Palestine and an increasingly insecure and isolated Israel. Joining us now is Ed Feline, who is the publisher and editor of the Southside Pride, a Minneapolis alternative monthly. He is the author of the revolutionary book, Taking the Streets. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Feline.
Hey, thanks very much. Nice to be here.
And I wanted to talk to you, since you're in Michelle Bachmann's hometown there, about Michelle Bachmann, who is, to many people, particularly on the progressive side, is a joke, but that doesn't mean she doesn't have a serious chance at firstly getting the Republican nomination to run as president. And it's not entirely out of the question that she could become president, because after all, many Americans woke up one day and found that Ronald Reagan was their president, who they thought was a joke. And then later they woke up and found that George W. Bush was their president and they thought he was a joke.
Right.
So give us your sense of what you think her chances are, and then we'll get into who she really is.
Frankly, I don't think her chances are that good. I think that you're correct in that she could pull it off, and there have been examples of people that like Bush, particularly Bush the Second, who was well below par, you would think, but managed to, with a smart organization, managed to pull it off. But I think what's going to happen is that she's going to peak after. After Iowa, like Huckabee did. I think that she has a Christian evangelical base of support. She's a kind of classic Midwestern Bible Belt Elmer Gantry huckster, and does a great job of spinning that thing. I think she believes it. And she's going to parlay that into a strong showing, I think, in the Iowa caucuses.
Well, but she did do well the other day in South Carolina, where she said she's got a titanium spine.
She's gonna do well in the Bible Belt. I mean, I think Thomas Frank's book, "What's the Matter with Kansas," is I think our best guide to understanding all of this. She's using wedge issues like gay rights and abortion to drive her people to the caucuses and to the polls and for support. And in the meantime, of course, she can give all the tax breaks she wants to the rich, and people who are living in trailer parks are going to end up voting for her because they think she's representing their notion of the American dream. I mean, it's pathetic and it's tragic, but that's the way in which she's rolled out her campaign. That's the way she's rolled out her political life up to now. She became really pretty pronounced as a strong national-type figure in 2004 during Bush's reelection campaign. She was a state senator from Minnesota, and she sponsored the gay rights, the ban on gay marriage in Minnesota, which, because of a DFL legislature, never got on the ballot. And but if it would have gotten on the ballot, probably in 2004, there's a good chance that it would have passed at that time. Today, the polls show that support for it is way, way down, and in fact, it'll probably fail even though there a Republican legislature has put it forward as a constitutional amendment for the next election, once again to try and drive Christian evangelicals to the polls, you know, which is what Karl Rove's strategy was in 2004. That's why there was all these gay rights amendments throughout the country, because he wanted to drive the Christian evangelicals to the polls.
Well, it's sort of curious to think that Michelle Bachmann, who was born Michelle Amble in Waterloo, Iowa, to a pair of lifelong Democrats, and her mother remarried, and she ended up in a kind of Brady Bunch family of nine kids. And one, of course, her step-siblings, Helen LaFave, has come out as a lesbian, even though Michelle Bachmann herself is clearly running on a homophobic ticket, if you will. But she is the candidate in many ways that many thought that Sarah Palin would become, and she's absolutely eclipsed Sarah Palin. I think all of the concern about Sarah Palin getting the nomination, I think, has gone by the wayside, as far as I can tell.
Oh yeah,
this is the one to watch, Michelle.
Oh, for sure,
Michelle Bachmann. When you say that, you know, she's out there on the loony fringe, I'm paraphrasing. You didn't say that.
Yeah.
But she did win her district, which is an independent district, and she won it by an 8-point margin. So she doesn't just simply appeal to the Christian evangelicals.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, she has a base, and you can't ignore that. And it's a scary kind of thing. I mean, she's using kind of socially fascistic notions. I mean, if you examine them closely, they're quite fascistic in the sense that, you know, gay people shouldn't be allowed to love anybody they want to love. Women should not be allowed to control their own bodies. Those are notions that I think America is moving away from.
Well, what about the McCarthyism, that the Democrats are a bunch of communist socialists? I mean, we haven't heard that kind of divisive rhetoric since the 1950s.
Yes. No, I think you're right. I think that she is bringing up. She's quite willing to scratch, you know, until something bleeds. You know, she'll go after it. And I mean, to call Obama un-American, you know, she's quite willing to throw bombs out there. And I think we have to be willing to handle those bombs and throw them back at her. I mean,
that gets to the real, I think, nub of the question here. Ed Feline, again, publisher and editor of the Southside Pride, a Minneapolis alternative monthly. He's also the author of the revolutionary book, Taking the Streets. This, I think, is really where the rubber meets the road in this discussion. It's what's happening in America, and there's a lot of anger and confusion, and, of course, the bad economy fuels that angst, and there's a distrust and a dislike of expertise. After all, the experts brought us the Wall Street crash, and people, I think, are, you know, in this environment where public education is basically becoming third world, that she could fill an important gap, because faith has replaced facts with a lot of people in this country.
Yes. Yeah. No. We're facing a tremendous economic crisis right now, and people are very frightened. And when people are frightened, they will tend to move in a reactionary way quite often. And if a politician knows how to manipulate fear, and I think that Michelle Bachmann, you know, has that capacity, I think that she'll be able to do quite well. And at the same time that's happening, all of the smart-ass intellectuals are kind of laughing up their sleeve at her, you know, and laughing at the spectacle of her making, you know, making mistakes all the time about, like, John Wayne's birthplace, when it's, you know, a serial killer and not John Wayne the movie star. I mean, there's lots of things that you can laugh at about that, but the important thing I think to understand is that that people who are frightened and don't have jobs and are afraid of what's coming down look to her for some kind of comfort because they recognize her as familiar, and they don't get that same kind of comfort from Obama or generally the Democrats, who are, you know, way too elitist for them. You know, I mean, there's Michelle Bachmann is a populist. She's a right wing populist, but she's a populist, and she knows how to talk in the language that people understand.
Well, Ed Feline, when you said earlier that she's really a believer in this Christian evangelical fundamentalism, I take it that she went to this Regent's University School of Law, which came to the surface during the Gonzalez-Bush Justice Department, where we found out that that a flood of these people from this law school that's ranked about the lowest in the country were suddenly getting important jobs in the Justice Department.
Right.
So that's where she went to law school.
Right.
But she was mentored by this Christian extremist professor named John Eidsmore, who's a contributor to the John Birch Society's publication. So give us a sense of where these extremist ideas incubated.
Yeah, that Christian law school actually fell apart. I mean, it's right after she graduated, and then it got assumed by
Oral Roberts or was it the Christian Broadcasting Network?
Yes. So I mean, it was totally unaccredited and totally bogus. But she's, you know, and then she spends her first real job is working for the tax department, collecting taxes on people, you know, and then she complains about the government, and she's getting government subsidies on her farm, and her husband's getting government subsidies for Medicare on his Christian evangelical psychological thing. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, bizarre contradictions in her, but
the Tea Party people don't care.
What?
Her Tea Party backers don't care. I mean, she was very clever to position herself as the head of the Tea Party caucus. She essentially usurped that role.
Yeah.
But she's got it. She's it. And what about you know, her chief of staff in the Congress quit in disgust, and now he's working for Pawlenty, and I believe Pawlenty just loathes her, right?
No, of course he hates her. Yeah, but it's a kind of weird rivalry. Pawlenty's a real case himself. I mean, his biggest bone donor is that Perry in Texas, who's the guy who funded the Swift boat thing, and in Pawlenty's reelection campaign for governor, when he ran for reelection, Perry dropped $500,000 at the last minute to put out a smear piece on the Democrats, so that even though Pawlenty was behind, he was able to pull ahead because of a last minute smear, sort of the Swift boat kind of thing that did in Kerry. But Pawlenty I get upset that nobody wants to talk about the fact that Pawlenty appointed his lieutenant governor to be head of the Department of Transportation in Minnesota as a kind of joke, so he could give her a raise and at the same time eliminate the salary for lieutenant governor. Why worry about it? Because you don't really need a head of Department of Transportation, because what could happen? A bridge could fall down or something. And then, of course, I-35 falls down, and because they haven't been looking at it, they haven't been taking the safety report seriously, people die as a result of his negligence. I mean, he has criminal culpability in neglecting the responsibilities of the state of Minnesota, and nobody's willing to talk about nobody wants to go back onto that thing, you know. I mean, I think that's an important example. I mean, what the hell is he going to do about Department of Defense? Is he going to make his wife head of Department of Defense so that he can give her a salary? I mean, is it doesn't make any sense.
Well, the good news is, I suppose, for those that consider Pawlenty a danger, is that he looks like he wimped out in that debate. He's made the most absurd economic proposals of even cutting more taxes, and somehow by magic the U.S. economy is going to grow 5% per annum. He's becoming a kind of a joke. But your point is well taken, that people ought to look into his background a little more, but. You know, I'm talking about the other Minnesota twin, Michelle Bachmann here.
Let's not get depressing.
At least she's entertaining, and she wiped the floor with most of those stiffs on that first debate. I mean, that's why I'm talking to you, because I think she's actually a very, very good candidate, in the sense that she's effective. And you know, she can say things like, you know, Obama's trip to India cost taxpayers $200 million a day, and Nancy Pelosi spent $100,000 on booze on state paid for flights aboard military jets and get away with it, even though there's no basis in fact. So, again, I get back to my concern that we're living in a fact-free zone here in America, and that because of a lack of education or the decline of education. And the general stress with the economy, she's authentic, and the liberals aren't trusted, and they're considered elitists, and that's a very effective campaign.
Oh, absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's like Weimar Germany. I mean, they're just whistling in the dark, thinking that who's going to take that clown seriously? You know that. That guy with the funny mustache, you know, it was a joke. I mean, he was nobody took him seriously, and I think that we know enough about history that we have to take Michelle Bachmann seriously. Whether or not she's going to get the Republican endorsement is another question, but we have to appreciate how she is manipulating her base, and we have to appreciate that is a political force, and it's a political force that has to be reckoned with, you know.
Well, Ed Feline, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for calling. It's really nice talking with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ed Feline, who's a publisher and editor of the Southside Pride, a Minneapolis alternative monthly. He's the author of the revolutionary book, Taking the Streets. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the health of Hugo Chavez. When she was an American girl, raised on promises, she couldn't help thinking that there was a little more life somewhere else. After all, it was a great big world with lots of places to run to. Yeah, did she Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Michael Shifter, who is president of the Inter-American Dialogue and co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He testifies regularly before the United States Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America and is a professor at Georgetown University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Shifter.
Thank you very much.
And there is clearly some confusion about the health of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and the extent to which his older brother, Adán Chavez, is rumored to be preparing to take charge in Caracas. Of course, Chavez is hospitalized in Cuba and was operated on June the 10th. He appeared briefly before the cameras, but that hasn't stopped the rumors. What's your sense about what is true here in terms of Hugo Chavez's health?
Well, there's been a lot of secrecy surrounding his condition, and so that's given rise to a lot of rumors and a lot of speculation. But I think we can say safely that he's got a health problem of some sort that's quite serious, because he decided to cancel a regional meeting of hemispheric leaders for July 5th. And this was something that's extremely important for him. He's been preparing for it for a long time. And the fact that it's canceled, it will be held later on this year, suggests that he's not well. How serious that is, whether he'll recover, how long that will take, I think is a matter of conjecture. But this is clearly not just a ploy on his part to build sympathy and come back to cheering masses in Venezuela. He does have some health problem.
Well, apparently the cover story, if you will, if indeed the health problems are worse than what the Venezuelan and Cuban authorities have announced, that they say he's being treated for a pelvic abscess. There's a report from the intelligence site Stratfor claiming a link to the president's medical team, saying that Hugo Chavez first underwent surgery in early May when he unexpectedly postponed a state visit to Brazil, and the official reason given was a knee injury. However, doctors discovered a tumor in the prostate. Then he went to Cuba, where his medical team discovered that the tumor had spread in the pelvic area. So if that is true, that's a far more serious prognosis.
Absolutely. That's been one of the reports that has been circulating, and a lot of people believe that that's true. Other people don't believe that's true, and so there have been a lot of reports. And the one you cite is one that's been around, but I'm not sure whether there really is any confirmation. And what's clear is that there have been very, very few details released. And so I've heard lots of stories as well, and I just hard to know what the truth is at this point.
Well, what we do know, I suppose, is that President Chavez's MO has been to sort of divide and conquer, if you will. It's notable that the Vice President, Elias Jora, is not assuming presidential duties, and the fact that his brother, who's a governor of one of the provinces, has suddenly showed up. I mean, to what extent is there a power vacuum here in terms of various factions that might be vying for power in the event of Hugo Chavez's illness being as serious as some suggest it is?
I think it's clear that, you know, that the strong man who's been in office for over 12 years is showing some human frailties and weaknesses. And there are a lot of people within his movement and his party who have been overshadowed by him, who are now emerging. And I think that's what we can expect. His brother is one of them, but there are others as well who will try to position themselves and say things to build political support. The vice president, according to the Constitution, should take over, not only if the president becomes incapacitated, but even when the president's outside of the country for an extended period. But the vice president is somebody who is not a strong figure, is not able to really, doesn't have the confidence of different sectors, and is not able to really govern the country. So the betting is that there's going to be a real struggle and a battle among different figures within the Chavez movement and party, to see who is able to sort of emerge at this time. There's been no successor. He hasn't groomed anybody. There was always a sense that he would sort of be immortal. And obviously, no matter what happens now, I think it's been clear to everybody that he does have some serious problems and weaknesses. And I think that will just change the political calculus of a lot of people that have been waiting around for a long time.
So what do you think is happening with the military, Michael Schifter, given, of course, that Hugo Chavez came out of the military, and he in fact tried a preemptive coup many years back before he was elected president. My understanding is that he has kept the military under control in part by using the Cubans to dominate military intelligence in order to to keep a check on any dissent within the military, within his own military, and that the group around the military are supposedly connected, heavily involved in drug trafficking. So give us a sense of this clique with around General Silver and the military intelligence.
Well, I think the first thing that has to be said is not a lot is known about the military. There are a lot of theories about it. There are a lot of people that I think claim to have some knowledge, but it's been really an institution that hasn't there hasn't been a lot of information. They've been very closed themselves. My guess, you know, there are sectors that are clearly very loyal to Chavez, others that are more professional, committed to the institution, but really have been very much going along because, not only because of the Cuban influence, but Chavez does have enjoyed popular support between 45-50%, according to latest polls. So they understand that this, you know, that the president is still popular, that they have to go along and sort of respect the institution. When you don't have that situation and there's an opening, and then I think you'll see different factions of the military sort of again jockeying for position. I think they'll be a lot more alert, a lot more attentive to what happens in the country. There's hopefully this situation will be resolved in a peaceful way, but there are risks that are out there. The bitterness is great, the distrust is great, and there are armed groups on both sides. So I think the military will be very attentive to that. But I think it's somehow it has functioned because not only because of the Cuban support, which clearly has been significant, but because Chavez himself has you know has been reelected, and he's whatever one thinks of him, he's somebody who has enjoyed at least 40-50% support. That will change. I think he'll be politically weakened, and I think the military will begin to play a much more important role, and I think some of the divisions within the military that have existed, I think, may come to the fore.
But it does seem, Michael Shifter, that Hugo Chavez has, as a hedge against any kind of military coup, he's created this National Bolivarian Militia, which is a sort of peasant army that is imbued with Chavista ideology.
That's right. I mean, I think that he's, you know, Chavez is somebody who doesn't really have a lot of trust, even towards his own armed forces. So this was a measure of protection that he developed to have militias that were personally loyal to him, which I think just heightens the risk and the danger, because you do have the armed forces there, but you also have other militias, and that's another group that's armed that will be vying for control and for power in this very, very complicated situation. So I think that even makes the risk of this current scenarios even more complicated.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Shifter, who is the president of the Inter-American Dialogue and a professor at Georgetown University, and we're talking about the rumors of a grave health condition that President Hugo Chavez is being treated for in Cuba, and what might happen in terms of filling a power vacuum. The brother, Adnan Chavez, his older brother, is the governor of Chavez's home state of Barinas. He, on June the 22nd, in an address that he made, this got a certain amount of attention. I'd just like to quote what he said. He quoted Che Guevara saying, "It would be inexcusable to limit ourselves to only the electoral end, not see other forms of struggle, including the armed struggle," clearly suggesting that if the elections don't go their way, they would resort to military power. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that he is trying to Adan really doesn't have a lot of support within the military. I think he's trying to establish his revolutionary credentials by talking about armed struggle. I think that he's somebody who has ambition, clearly has been close to his brother, but is politically doesn't have a solid base, doesn't have support in the armed forces, barely won election to their home state of Barinas in the election. So he, I think, is an unlikely person to step in, but I think he wants to strengthen his chances, and I think he wants to show that he's a true revolutionary, as Chavez has tried to show that he's a true revolutionary, and try to put himself in a stronger political position. Should Chavez need to step down, then he would be seen as somebody who could step in. So I think this is a posturing game that's going on, and I think we're going to see statements of other members of Chavez's coalition, not only his brother but others as well, both in and out of government. And again, this is going to be, I think, a pretty fierce political battle.
Well, throughout this discussion, Michael Shifter, we haven't mentioned the opposition. You say he's been elected with roughly 50%. It is a very divided country. Whenever I talk to anybody, they're either fierce Chavistas, pro-Chavez, or they just violently hate the man. So he's a very polarizing figure, shall we say.
Yes, he's a very polarizing figure, and for all of the uncertainty and the chaos in Venezuela, he's also the figure that's held things together, both within his own coalition, the Chavistas, who clearly have been loyal to him, as well as the opposition, who have been united in their desire to try to defeat him next year in the election. With him out of the picture, things are complicated not only within his own coalition, but I think also in the opposition as well. The opposition will probably feel very encouraged in the sense that there's nobody within Chavismo who would be such a formidable opponent as Hugo Chavez, and perhaps they'll feel they have the luxury, perhaps, to become to stake out their own positions, because it's a very heterogeneous group in the opposition, and that would risk some splintering and fracturing of the opposition in this scenario. They've been united because I think they feel that Chavez has been there for so long and that he's vulnerable, and they've improved their electoral strategy and they've tried to come together. But this may throw them off a little bit. He has sort of oddly been a sort of a somebody who has mobilized and brought together the opposition. So they're going to face some real major challenge of trying to stay together and trying to stay focused on whatever the political scenario is to try to come in office. But there's going to be a lot of temptations to move in different directions and to split up.
But my understanding from people that I talk to in Venezuela is that life down there is getting more insecure, shall we say. It may be getting better for the core supporters, the poor, the Bolivarian circles, as Chavez calls them. But I understand there's an enormous rise in the crime rate. There's a great deal of insecurity. You get these anecdotal reports that this is a country that could come unglued.
Yes, I think that the Caracas, the capital of Venezuela, has among the highest murder rates in the world. The figures are really off the charts for the level of crime and violence in the country. So far, there really hasn't been political violence per se, but that I think is the fear that you could have this sort of substantial, widespread criminal violence and insecurity that has been spreading in the country, together with real political violence, which would make the situation extremely problematic. I don't think Venezuelans, want to think that they understand that if things get out of control, that would really put things on the line. And I think that most Venezuelans are, very peaceful and nonviolent. But I do think one shouldn't rule out the risks, given the desperation economically of a lot of people, given the security situation, which is very serious, and compounded now by what could be sort of a leadership vacuum and no institutions. That's not a country. Chavez has really exercise one man rule for over 12 years. So that I think is the real concern of simply the problems that have mounted and avoid in terms of institutions that could take over and really keep things under control. And I think that's there's very valid concerns about what could come next.
Well, just in the last minute then, in terms of the rise in crime, is this in any way connected with this this clique in the military that's supposedly heavily involved in drug traffic and Venezuela's money laundering schemes that have debilitated a lot of the, or looted a lot of the Venezuelan state firms?
This is certainly a part of it. I think there's no question. It's been widely documented. A lot of drugs now passes through Venezuela. Much of it goes to Europe and elsewhere. And there are parts of the military that are involved. And so this is I think is a piece of a factor within a much larger, complicated situation. It's not just the drug problem, but it really is, in part, an economic situation, in part, just the availability of arms. But it's a series of problems that have come together that have produced tremendous insecurity. There's high levels. There's a lot of kidnapping in Venezuela now. Some of it is related to drugs. A lot of it's not related to drugs. So I think a lot of things have come together, but the overall situation is very, very insecure. And if you look at any kind of poll about what Venezuelans worry about, it's really quite striking the degree to which this is such a major concern for ordinary Venezuelans.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Michael Shifter.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Shifter, who is the president of the Inter-American Dialogue and a professor at Georgetown University. Let's now take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined by Daniel Byman.
Este canto es para referirme a un hombre que cree que tiene el mundo entero en sus manos, no sabiendo que está muy equivocado y se le puede venir un hecatombe. Con ese armamento se cree un Superman. A Uribe y los gringos maldice y ultraja. El tiro le va a salir por la culata y como a Saddam Hussein le va a pasar. Deja la amenazadera, porque tú lo sabes, Chávez, que cerquita la frontera.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Daniel Byman, who is Director of Research at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, where he focuses on counterterrorism and Middle East security. He's also a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program and served as a staff member on the 9/11 Commission. His new book just out is A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And this week, of course, the United States, the White House counterterrorism czar announced a new counterterrorism strategy. And we've always assumed here in the United States that the Israelis are the ones to emulate. They're the best at it. What's your sense, given all the work you've done in terms of your new book?
The Israelis are both worthy of emulation and also teach us lessons of what to avoid. The Israelis are really good at gathering intelligence. They're really good at military operations against terrorists. But they often think in the short term, and they need work on developing long-term approaches to counterterrorism.
Well, Israel is unique politically in the extent to which senior intelligence officials sort of rotate back as senior politicians. Sipi Livni, the head of Kadima, being an example of, you know, a Mossad senior operations officer with the Mossad, now head of a political party. I don't think here in the United States there'd be any equivalent. But what seems to be happening now in Israel is that a number of senior intelligence officials are going public and lambasting the sitting government and warning the Israeli people that that Netanyahu is likely to attack Iran. And this is not just the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, but former head of military intelligence, the former head of Shin Bet. They're all weighing in. So what's happening there in Israel?
There's a real distrust in Israel between the senior security officials and the Netanyahu government. A number of them see him as someone who is far more political than they would like, someone who is willing to do quite risky things like attack Iran. They're worried that he would do it in part to shore up his political stature rather than because it's the right thing to do.
And what's your sense of that?
In my view, an Israeli attack on Iran would be a huge mistake. Should Israel attack, there's a real question as to how effective the operation would be and whether it would truly set the Iranians back more than a short period of time. But also the Iranians could retaliate. And unfortunately for the United States, it's easier for the Iranians to retaliate next door in Iraq in particular and also in Afghanistan. And so the United States might bear some of the burden for an Israeli strike.
Well, presumably the United States has let Netanyahu know, wouldn't you think?
I think there's no doubt on that. Certainly under President Bush, Secretary of Defense Gates made it clear to the Israelis that this was not something the United States favored. And my understanding is the Obama administration is even more skeptical. So clearly the Israelis know. But Israel has always made it clear that it will act in its own interests. And this is something American leaders are aware of.
So, Daniel Bowman, I understand that what is exacerbating this insecurity in Israel, where as we're discussing, the military and intelligence people are skeptical of the government and feel that the Prime Minister Netanyahu might do something militarily that's rash for political reasons. Now, what apparently is weighing on the political establishment in Israel is this ticking clock with the Palestinians declaring statehood through the United Nations. And that was the assumption that on the part of Maya Dagan to go public. How does that fit into this mix?
The Palestinian decision to go before the UN and get UN General Assembly approval to be a state is something that has worried Israelis quite a bit. They're concerned that this will further legitimate the Palestinians. It will increasingly isolate Israel. In part, I think this is an overreaction. One thing I ask Palestinian officials is, okay, having declared a state, how does this change the situation on the ground in October after such a declaration? And the real answer is not much. But symbolically, it's very important. It's a way that the Palestinians are trying to really keep pressure on Israel, and Israel doesn't have a response because there isn't a robust peace process. There isn't a way for Israel to say, you should use this alternative or this alternative. So Israel correctly feels that it's being bypassed and will look bad as a result.
But as you point out in your new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism, Daniel Bowman, is that paradoxically the Israelis depend upon the Palestinian security forces on the West Bank to do much of the heavy lifting in counterterrorism. And now Israel's basically saying the deal that Fatah's made with, the Palestinian authorities made with Hamas, they're not going to support that. And essentially, all bets could be off, couldn't they?
That's one of the great ironies, is today keeping Israel safe from terrorism depends on Palestinian officials, especially in the West Bank. And should relations sour between the more moderate Palestinian officials and Israel, it can certainly make the situation less secure for Israel. Now, Palestinian officials, President Abbas, Prime Minister Fayyad, they're cracking down on groups like Hamas, and they have in the past, because they see them as rivals. It's in their own interest. But with the unity agreement with Hamas, there's going to be real pressure on the moderates to not act. And if there is no peace deal that's ongoing, it's going to be harder and harder for Israel to put pressure on the moderates to say, you have to do this, because Israel will have less leverage.
But in the broader context of the Arab Spring, it seems that the Netanyahu government is sort of somewhat flat-footed and maybe out of touch with history here. They're not welcoming these changes. They're actually afraid of these changes.
Early on, the Israeli reaction to the Arab Spring was that this is more likely to be Tehran in 1979 than Prague, say, after the end of the Cold War. And there was a real fear that these revolutions would lead to an Islamist takeover or could lead to chaos. And as we all know, the verdict is still out on what's going to happen in Egypt and Tunisia or Syria, for that matter. But Israelis point out that they've made peace successfully with two governments, the government of Jordan and Egypt under Anwar Sadat. And both of these were dictatorships. So for Israel, having a more democratic government come in or instability does not necessarily mean peace is more likely.
And but in just in terms of the sweep of history, you would think that Israel, being the only democracy in the Middle East, could position itself as a mentor rather than an opponent.
That would be the hope, although I think, unfortunately, that's unrealistic. Israel's popularity rating in among Arab states is incredibly low, and that's among democratic forces as well as among Islamists or supporters of the old regime. So even if Israel has lessons to offer, I don't think anyone in the Arab world is likely to listen.
And my understanding that in Israel itself, there's more and more of a siege mentality developing, isn't there, as they lose Mubarak and as the King of Jordan. I wouldn't say shaky, but at least, there's some rumblings there. Is that what you observe?
That's right. Israel has looked to these Arab dictators and seen them as potential friends. They're moderate in their policy towards Israel. And Israelis' concern is that if a government comes in Egypt, say, that truly reflects popular opinion, that government is going to be a lot more hostile to Israel just because the ordinary Egyptian is much more hostile to Israel than was Mubarak.
And how is this translating, though, in terms of Israel's politics? Because I noticed that relatively recently, actually maybe 6 months ago it was, former President Clinton mentioned that Israel's, one of the reasons why peace was less and less attainable, or that we had a peace process as opposed to peace, was that the Israeli political center was moving to the right, and Clinton attributed that to the Russian emigres. So has Israel become not just more of a siege mentality, but also more of a kind of right-wing bastion?
I think that's correct. There are disputes as to why this is so, but clearly the political center of Israel has moved to the right. In many ways, the biggest challenge to Prime Minister Netanyahu is not the traditional Labor Party or even the center-of-the-road Kadima Party, but forces on his own right. So when he's thinking about making a deal, he's thinking that it could hurt him with his conservative base, and so he's very, very cautious about anything that could alienate them.
Well, my understanding, Daniel Bowman, is that forces on his right are right at home. His own father, apparently, thinks his son's a liberal.
That's exactly, I think you're actually quite right on that this is, I'll just simply say that Israel has moved fairly steadily to the right, and there are a lot of reasons for that, some societal and some, I think, because of Israel's negative experience with peace talks and the second intifada after that. And this has, unfortunately, makes it much more difficult for a peace deal to be achieved.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Bowman, who is professor at Georgetown University and the author of this new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. And the book talks about the Battle of Jenin and why that was a turning point in Israel's counterterrorism efforts. Explain that, if you would, Daniel.
The Jenin operation is part of a broader military operation where Israel reoccupies much of the West Bank, and this occurs really near the height of the Second Intifada. Before Jenin, Israel had a very hard time getting intelligence in the West Bank, and even when it got intelligence, it often wasn't able to act on it because it couldn't move quickly enough. When it tried to arrest someone, they simply moved before Israeli forces could arrive. After Israel goes into Jenin and goes into other places, in the West Bank, there's tremendous criticism. It's, in so doing, it's essentially said, peace talks are over. We're not going to respect the autonomy that the Palestinians were granted. And the Jenin and other operations at times are quite bloody. And so Israel's widely criticized. But over time, this is a tremendously effective counterterrorism operation. By having forces on the ground, Israel is able to gather a massive amount of intelligence. It's able to detain many suspects, which produces even more intelligence. And by establishing checkpoints, by creating a military presence on the ground, it can move very quickly and do arrests and target killings quite rapidly. This sort of operation, however, is very costly for Israel politically. The United States at first is critical, and around the world, of course, there's tremendous criticism of Israel for reoccupying the West Bank. And this is really a theme of my book, which is some of Israel's most effective measures from a counterterrorism point of view are also quite costly politically and especially to the Palestinians who are affected by this. So there are really sharp trade-offs, unfortunately.
Well, but clearly, subsequent to that, the Gaza siege and then the Turkish flotilla, where Israel came into enormous international or provoked enormous international outrage on both accounts. Can you make that argument there that there was any value in terms of counterterrorism?
The flotilla was part of stopping the flotilla was part of the broader effort to keep Gaza isolated, to prevent things going in and out of Gaza without Israeli approval. But it was a disaster from a public relations point of view. Israel looked both cruel and incompetent, and that's an extremely dangerous combination. And as a result, groups like Hamas took heart. They believed that they could end their isolation through embarrassing the Israelis, through international pressure that would force the Israelis to make changes. So when Israel does this sort of isolation, it often doesn't factor in international opinion and how it's going to look in the media, and then is sent reeling when it turns out there's quite a negative reaction. And this is something Israel needs to do better on.
Well, clearly they have a second chance, if you will, if this flotilla materializes. This new flotilla, which may have been sabotaged, but I think something's going to show up soon. So.
How Israel handles the new flotilla is going to be very interesting, because do they recognize the power of the media? Do they recognize that they need images that show that Israel is responsive to the human situation in Gaza, even as it tries to enforce a degree of a blockade for security reasons? And this is particularly important because of the Arab Spring today. Israel, for the most part, has not been an issue in the Arab Spring, but high-profile issues like the flotilla have the potential to bring Israel into this, and perhaps in quite a negative way. Perhaps the flotilla will divert attention on Israel, and as a result, there'll be a waning of attention on the need for shoring up democratic institutions.
Well, what about the Gaza incident? Wasn't that a catastrophe? I'm just curious to know whether there was any gains in terms of counterterrorism there, as opposed to the amount of outrage that it generated around the world.
When Israel went into Gaza in 2008, and this continued into operations continued into 2009, the devastation was considerable. There was devastation to Gaza's infrastructure. In addition, while many Hamas people died, so too did many civilians. The outrage still lingers today, and Israel is paying the price. Israel is increasingly unpopular, and its legitimacy is questioned. However, many Israelis believe this was a tremendous success. Hamas had been launching rockets on a fairly regular basis before this operation, and while there had been a ceasefire, it had commenced again to launch rockets right before the operation began. After the operation ended, Hamas's rockets really diminished. We see a huge change in late 2009 after the operation when you compare it to, say, 2007. And so Israelis believe that while their use of force was quite heavy, it served the ends of deterrence, that they scared Hamas, and that Hamas doesn't want a second round. So their view was the heavy use of force was productive in reducing the number of rocket attacks.
Well, if you could give me a quick 30-second answer here, the other accusation by the former head of Mossad was that Netanyahu blew the opportunity the Saudis offered for a comprehensive peace deal. Do you think that was a disaster?
The Saudi offer was many years ago, but there's a real question, which is there a possibility of bringing the Arab states on board as well as the Palestinians? And the idea is they would reinforce each other. The Arab states would give the Palestinians political support, and if the Palestinians bought it, it would enable the Arab states to be more moderate to Israel. In my view, the Saudi offer was quite dramatic. Saudi Arabia, of course, always very hostile to Israel, and has tries to promote strong Islamist credentials. So if Saudi Arabia could be on board as a potential partner for peace, that's quite an accomplishment. There would be a lot to do, though. The Saudi position was quite far from the Israeli position, but to me it's something that should have been pursued more aggressively.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Daniel Barman.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Daniel Barman is a professor at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service and is the author of a new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our production intern is Graham Fitzgibbon. Our theme music is by Los Lobos, and you can check it out at ianmasters.com. Again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel song about the home of the brave in this land here, the free, one time, one night in America. Four small boys playing ball in the parking lot. A preacher, a teacher, and the other became